This is Audible.
Chapter 6, in which I get busted in Redlands, escape to Morocco in the Bentley, do a moonlight flit with Anita Pallenberg, make my first courtroom appearance, spend a night in the scrubs, and a summer in Rome. Cecil Beaton in Morocco, 1967. From Self-Portrait with Friends, The Selected Diaries of Cecil Beaton, 1926 to 1974. No group makes more of a mess at the table. The aftermath of their breakfast with eggs, jam, honey everywhere is quite exceptional. They give a new meaning to the word untidiness. The drummer, Keith, as it was written, of the Stones, an 18th century suit, long black velvet coat and the tightest pants. Everything is shoddy, poorly made, the seams burst. Keith himself had sewn his trousers, lavender and dull rose, with a band of badly stitched leather dividing the two colours. Brian appears in white pants, with a huge black square applied at the back. It is very smart, in spite of the fact that the seams are giving way. 1967 was the watershed year, the year the seams gave way. There was that feeling that trouble was coming, which it did later, with all the riots, street fighting and all of that. It was a tension in the air. It's like negative and positive ions before a storm. You get that breathlessness that something's got to break. In fact, all it did was crack. We'd finished touring the previous summer, a grueling American tour, and wouldn't tour there again for 2 years. In all that time, the first 4 years of the band, I don't think we ever had more than 2 days' rest between playing, travelling and recording. We were always on the road. I felt I'd come to the end of an episode with Brian. At least it couldn't go on as it had while we were touring. Mick and I had gotten incredibly nasty to Brian when he became a joke, when he effectively gave up his position in the band. Things had been bad before that, too. I mean, there had been tension way before Brian started becoming an arsehole. But I was trying to mend fences at the end of 1966. We were a band, after all. I was footloose, fancy-free, having ended my affair with Linda Keith. And when Brian wasn't working, it was easier. And naturally I gravitated to Brian's and Anita's, Courtfield Road, near Gloucester Road. We had a lot of fun, becoming friends again, getting stoned together. It was wonderful at first. So I started to move in with him. Brian saw my attempts to bring him back into the centre as an opportunity to start a vendetta against Mick. Brian always had to have an imaginary enemy, and around this time he decided it was Mick Jagger who had grossly mistreated and offended him. I just hung out as a guest and got a ringside seat on the world that Anita attracted around her, which was an exceptional gang of people. I used to walk back through Hyde Park to St. John's Wood at 6 in the morning at first, just to pick up a clean shirt, and then I just stopped going home. In those days on Courtfield Road, I had nothing to do with Anita, strictly speaking. I was fascinated by her from what I thought was a safe distance. I thought certainly that Brian had got very lucky. I could never figure out how he got his hands on her. My first impression was of a woman who was very strong. I was right about that. Also an extremely bright woman. That's one of the reasons she sparked me. Let alone that she was so entertaining and such a great beauty to look at. Very funny. Cosmopolitan beyond anyone I'd come across. She spoke 3 languages. She'd been here, she'd been there, was very exotic to me. I loved her spirit. Even though she would instigate and turn the screw and manipulate, she wouldn't let you off the hook for a minute. If I said, "That's nice," she would say, "Nice? I hate that word. Oh, stop being so fucking bourgeois. We're going to fight about the word nice? How would you know?" Her English was still a bit patchy, so she would break out in German occasionally when she really meant something. "Excuse me, I'll have that translated." Anita, sexy fucking bitch. One of the prime women in the world. It was all building up in Courtfield Gardens. Brian would crash out sometimes, and Anita and I would look at each other. But that's Brian and his old lady, and that's it, hands off. The idea of stealing a band member's woman was not on my agenda, and so the days went by. The truth was, I'm looking at Anita, and I'm looking at Brian, and I'm looking at her, and I'm thinking, there's nothing I can do about this. I'm gonna have to be with her. I'm gonna have her, or she's gonna have me. One way or another. The realization didn't help things. There was this obvious electricity over a few months, and Brian became more and more tangential. It took a lot of patience on my part. I'd stay around there 3 or 4 days, and once a week I'd walk to St. John's Wood. Better give some space here. It's too transparent what my feelings are. But there were many other people around. It was a continuous party. Brian was desperately in need of attention all the time. But the more he got, the more he wanted. Also, I was getting the flavor of what was going on between Brian and Anita. I would hear the thumping some nights, and Brian would come out with a black eye. Brian was a woman beater. But the one woman in the world you did not want to try and beat up on was Anita Pallenberg. Every time they had a fight, Brian would come out bandaged and bruised. But it was nothing to do with me. Was it? I was there only to hang with Brian. Anita came out of an artistic world, and she had quite a bit of talent herself. She was certainly a lover of art, and Pally with its contemporary practitioners, wrapped up in the pop art world. Her grandfather and great-grandfather were painters, a family that had gone down, apparently, in a blaze of syphilis and madness. Anita could draw. She grew up in her grandfather's big house in Rome, but spent her teens in Munich at a decadent German aristocrat school where they threw her out for smoking, drinking, and worst of all, hitchhiking. When she was 16, she got a scholarship to a graphic school in Rome near the Piazza del Popolo, which was when she started hanging out at that tender age in the cafes with the Roman intelligentsia, Fellini and all those people, as she put it. Anita had a lot of style. She also had an amazing ability to put things together, to connect with people. This was Rome in the Dolce Vita period. She knew all the filmmakers, Fellini, Visconti, Pasolini. In New York, she connected with Warhol, the pop art world, and the beat poets. Mostly through her own skills, Anita was brilliantly connected to many worlds and many different people. She was the catalyst of so many goings-on in those days. If there was a genealogical tree, tree of Genesis of London's hip scene, the one that it was known for in those days, Anita and Robert Fraser, the gallery owner and art dealer, would be at the top. Besides Christopher Gibbs, the antique dealer and bibliophile, and a few other major courtiers. And that was mainly because of the connections they'd made. Anita had met Robert Fraser a long way back in 1961, when she was tied up with the early pop art world through her boyfriend Mario Schifano, a leading pop painter in Rome. Through Fraser, she'd met Sir Mark Palmer, the original Gypsy Baron, and Julian and Jane Ormsby Gore, and Tara Brown, subject of the Beatles' A Day in the Life. So already a basis is laid for the meeting of music, which played a big part in the art underground from early on. And the aristos, even though these were not your usual aristos. Here you had three old Etonians, Fraser, Gibbs, and Palmer. Though it turned out that two of them, Fraser and Gibbs, had been sacked from Eton or left prematurely, and each had special eccentric talents and a strong personality. They were not born to follow the herd. Mick and Marianne would make pilgrimages with John Mitchell, a writer, and the Merlin of the group, to Herefordshire to observe flying saucers and ley lines and all that. Anita had a Paris life, dancing around nightly and diaphanously in regimes where they let her in for free. She had an equally glamorous Roman life. She worked as a model and she got parts in movies. The people she mixed with were hardcore avant-garde in the days when hardcore hardly existed. And that was when the drug culture had started to explode. First came the Mandrax with the grass, then the acid in late 66, then the coke sometime in 67, then the smack. Always. I remember David Quartz, the original maker of my skull ring, still a close friend, coming out to dinner in a pub near Redlands. He'd had some Mandrax and some bevvies and now wanted to rest his head in the soup. I remember it only because Mick carried him on his back to the car. He would never do something like that now. And I realize, remembering that incident, how very long ago it was that Mick changed. But that is another country. Oh, they were some fascinating people. Captain Fraser, who'd had a commission in the King's African Rifles, the strong arm of colonial authority in East Africa, was posted in Uganda, where Idi Amin was his sergeant. He turned into Strawberry Bob, floating around in slippers and Rajasthani trousers by night, and gangster-sharp pinstripes and polka-dot suits by day. The Robert Fraser Gallery was pretty much the cutting edge. He was putting on Jim Dine shows. He represented Liechtenstein. He did Warhol's first thing in London, showing Chelsea girls in his flat. He showed Larry Rivers, Rauschenberg. Robert saw all the changes coming. He was very into pop art. He was aggressively avant-garde. I liked the energy that was going into it, rather than necessarily everything that was being done. It was that feeling in the air that anything was possible. Otherwise, the stunning, overblown pretentiousness of the art world made my skin crawl cold turkey. And I wasn't even using the stuff. Allen Ginsberg was staying at Mick's place in London once. I spent an evening listening to the old gasbag pontificating on everything. It was the period when Ginsberg sat around playing a concertina badly and making om sounds, pretending he was oblivious to his socialite surroundings. Captain Fraser really loved his Otis Redding and his Booker T and the MGs. I'd sometimes drop by his flat in Mount Street, the salon of the period, in the morning, if I'd been up all night, and I'd just got the new Booker T or Otis album. And there was Mohammed, the Moroccan servant in the Jalaba, preparing a couple of pipes, and we'd listen to Green Onions or Chinese Checkers or Chained and Bound. Robert was into smack. He had a cupboard full of double-breasted suits, all superbly made, with great fabrics, and his shirts were often handmade bespoke shirts. But the collars and cuffs were always frayed, and that was part of the look. And he used to keep spare jacks, a sixth of a grain, it was six jacks to a grain of heroin, loose in these suit pockets. So he'd always be going to the cupboard and going through all the pockets to find the odd spare jack. Our Robert's flat was full of fantastic objects. Tibetan skulls lined with silver, bones with silver caps on the end, Tiffany Art Nouveau lamps and beautiful fabrics, textiles everywhere. He'd float around in his bright-coloured silk shirts he brought back from India. Our Robert really liked to get stoned. Wonderful hashish. Afghani primo. He was a weird mixture of avant-garde and very old-fashioned. The other thing I really liked about Robert was he had no side on him. He could have easily hidden behind Eton and the patrician style, but he looked around. He deliberately showed works of art by people not in the Royal Academy. And then, of course, there was the homosexual pufta bit that also put him at odds. He didn't flaunt it, but he certainly didn't hide it. He had a steely eye, and I always admired his guts. And I put a lot of that persona of his down to the African rifles, really. He had his eyes open in Africa. Captain Robert Fraser retired. If he wanted to, he could pull rank. But I have the feeling with Robert that he just detested more and more the way that the establishment at that time, as they called it, was still trying to cling on to something that was obviously crumbling. I admired his stand on "this cannot go on." And I think that's why he attached himself to us, and the Beatles, and the avant-garde artists. Fraser and Christopher Gibbs have been at Eton together. When Anita first met Gibby, way back, he'd just come out of jail for taking a book from Sotheby's, age 18 or something. Always a passionate collector and with a very good eye. We linked up with Gibbs again through Robert when Mick decided he wanted to have a country life. Robert was not country inclined and said, "You better get Gibby onto this." So Gibbs started showing Mick and Marianne around England, and they looked at various palaces and estates. I've always loved Gibby in his own way. I used to stay at his apartment at Cheyne Walk on the embankment. He had a great library of books. I could just sit around, look at beautiful first editions, and great illustrations and paintings and stuff that I hadn't had time to get into because I've been working on the road. Very much in the flog and the furniture. Very nice pieces. A subtle promoter of his own wares. I've got this wonderful chest, 16th century. He was always flogging something off, or something was always available. At the same time, he was crazy, Christopher. He's the only guy I know that would actually wake up and break an amyl nitrate popper under his nose. That even took me out. He'd have one by the side of the bed, just twist that little yellow file and wake up. I saw him do it. I was amazed. I didn't mind the poppers, but usually later at night. What Robert Fraser and Christopher Gibbs had in common was nerve and fearlessness, more front than Selfridge's. And they were mama's boys. Big mama fear amongst a lot of them. Maybe that's why they were all puffs. Strawberry Bob. He was always scared of his mum. "Oh, my mother's coming." "So what?" Which didn't mean they were soft or pussy-whipped. It was just the respect for their mothers that was overpowering. Obviously, they had very strong mothers, because these guys were very strong guys. Only now have I learned that Gibby's mother was queen of the Girl Guides worldwide, the chief commissioner for overseas. It's not something we talked about in those days. I never realised the influence of this duo back then, but they changed the landscape and they greatly influenced the style of the times. Gibbs and Fraser were only the front names and all that. There were Lampsons and Lamptons, Sykeses, Michael Rainey. There was Sir Mark Palmer, page boy to the Queen, an inveterate didicroy, bless his heart. Him and the gold teeth and the whippets tied to baling twine, and the caravans that used to trundle through the country lanes and park on the estates of his friends. I guess if you're brought up and trained to carry the Queen's frock, gypsy caravan might look kind of attractive after a while. It was all right before you got hair on your cock, but after that, what do? I haul the Queen's frock? Suddenly, we were being courted by half the aristocracy, the younger scions, the heirs to some ancient pile, the Ormsby Gores, the tenants, the whole lot. I've never known if they were slumming or we were snobbing. They were very nice people. I decided it was no skin off my nose. If somebody's interested, they're welcome. You want to hang? You want to hang? Yeah, it was the first time I know of when that lot actively sought out musicians in such large numbers. They realised there was something blowing in the wind, to quote Bob. They felt embarrassed up there, the knights in blue, and they felt they were being left out of things if they didn't join in. So there was this weird mixture of aristos and gangsters, the fascination that the higher end of society has with the more brutish end. And that was particularly the case with Robert Fraser. Robert liked to mix with the underworld. Maybe it was his rebellion against the suffocation of his background, or the repression of homosexuality. He gravitated towards people like David Litvinov, who was on the borders of art and villainy, a friend of the Cray brothers, the East End gangsters. Though there were villains in the story as well. Well, that's how Tony Sanchez came into it. Because Tony Sanchez helped Robert out of a tight spot when he had gambling debts. And that's how Robert met Tony. So Tony became Robert's conduit, sort of helper out with villains and his dealer. Tony rang a gambling casino for Spanish waiters in London after hours. He was a dope dealer and a gangster with a Mark 10 Jag, two-tone, all done up pimp style. His father ran a famous Italian restaurant in Mayfair. Spanish Tony was a hard man. Biff bang, one of those. He was a great guy until he became a bad one. His trouble, just like many others, was that you can't be like that and also become a junkie. The two don't mix. If you're going to be a hard man, if you're going to be smart beyond your toes, which is what Tony could have been and was for a while, you can't afford to be on dope. It slows you down. If you're going to be selling it, okay, that's the way it is, but don't sample it. There's a big difference between a dealer and a consumer. To be a dealer, you've got to be way in front. Otherwise, you slip up. And that's what happened to Tony. He set me up a couple of times. Without my knowing it, I found out later. He used me as a getaway driver on a hit-and-run jewel theft in the Burlington Arcade. Here, Keith, I've got this Jag. Do you want to try it out? What they wanted was a clean car and a clean driver. And Tony had obviously told his blokes that I was a good night driver. So I waited outside this place, not knowing what was happening. Tony was a good mate of mine, but he used to stitch me up. Another good friend, Michael Cooper. I used to hang with a lot. Great photographer. He could hang and hang. He could take so much stuff. He was the only photographer I ever knew who actually had a tremor when he was taking pictures. And yet they'd come out right. How did you do that? Your hands were trembling. The whole picture should be a blur. Well, I know just when to push. Michael recorded the early Stones life in great detail because he never stopped taking pictures. Pictures were a total way of life for Michael. He was absolutely captured by images. Or more likely, images had captured him. Michael was Robert's creature in a way. Robert had a Svengali side to him and was strongly attracted to Michael Cooper on all sorts of levels. But he particularly admired Michael's artistry, and he promoted him. Michael was a networker. He was the glue between us. All these different parts of London, the Aristos and the Hoods and the others. When you take all the stuff we took, you're always talking about everything else rather than what you're working at, which meant Michael and me sitting around talking about the quality of the dope. Two fiends looking to see if they can get higher than ever before without damaging themselves too much. No talking about the great work I'm going to do or you're going to do or anybody else is going to do. I mean, that was peripheral. I knew how hard he worked. He was manic like me, but you took it for granted. One thing about Michael was that he would spiral into deep, ominous depressions. Black dogs. The poet of the lens was a more fragile creature than one imagined. Michael spun slowly towards a bourne from which there was no return. But for now, we were basically gangsters. Not that we pulled any jobs, but we were an elite little circle. Flamboyant and outrageous. Quite honestly, pushing all the margins because it had to be done. Well, there's not much you can really say about acid, except, God, what a trip. Stepping off into this area was very uncertain, uncharted. In the years 1967, 68, there was a real turnover in the feeling of what was going on. A lot of confusion and a lot of experimentation. The most amazing thing that I can remember on acid is watching birds fly. Birds that kept flying in front of my face that weren't actually there. Flocks of birds of paradise. And actually, it was a tree blowing in the wind. I was walking down a country lane. It was very green, and I could almost see every wing movement. It was slowed down to the point where I could even say, shit, I could do that. That's why I understand the odd person jumping out of a window, because the whole notion of how it's done is suddenly clear. A flock of birds took about half an hour to fly across my vision, an incredible fluttering, and I could see every feather. And they looked at me while they did it, like, try that on for size. Shit. Okay, there's some things I can't do. You had to be with the right people when you were taking acid. Otherwise, beware. Brian on acid, for example, was a loose cannon. Either he'd be incredibly relaxed and funny, or he'd be one of the cats that would lead you down the bad road when the good road closes. And suddenly you're going there, down the streets of paranoia. And on acid, you can't really control it. Why am I going into his black dot? I just don't want to go there. Let's go back to the crossroads and see if the good road opens. I want to see that flock of birds again and have a few astounding ideas for playing and find the lost chord. The holy grail of music, very fashionable at the time. There were a lot of pre-Raphaelites running around in velvet with scarves tied to their knees, like the Ormsby Gores, looking for the holy grail. The lost court of King Arthur, UFOs and ley lines. With Christopher Gibbs, you actually couldn't tell whether he was on acid or not, because that's the way he was. Maybe I never knew Christopher off acid, but I must say he was an adventurous lad. He was ready to jump into the unknown, into the valley of death. He was ready to look into it. It was something that had to be done. I never saw Gibbs unbalanced by acid, never saw any sign of a bad trip. My memories of Christopher are that he was somehow always angelically 3 feet off the ground, as we all were, perhaps. No one knew much about this. We were tapping in the dark. I found it very interesting, but at the same time, I found other people got quite distressed. And that's all you need on this kind of stuff, is to deal with somebody who really is having a bad trip. People could change and become very paranoid or very uptight or very scared, especially Brian. It could happen to anybody, but that would turn other people into a bad time too. It was the unknown with acid. You didn't know if you'd come back or not. I had a couple of terrible trips. I remember Christopher talking me down. Hey, everything is cool. It's all right. He was just like a nurse, a night nurse. I can't even remember what the hell I was going through. It just wasn't pleasant. Paranoia, maybe. The same with a lot of people with marijuana. It makes them paranoid. It's basically fear, but you don't know of what, so you have no defense. And the further you go down there, the bigger it gets. Sometimes you gotta slap yourself. But it didn't stop me from having another trip. It was the idea of a boundary that had to be pushed. There's a bit of stupidity there as well. Wasn't so good last time. Let's try again. What, are you chicken now? It was the acid test, Ken Kesey's goddamn thing. It meant if you hadn't been there, you ain't nowhere, which is really dumb. A lot of people felt obliged to take it, even if they didn't want to, if they wanted to stay and hang with the crowd. It was a gang thing, but it could shake you if you weren't careful, and that happened a lot. Even if you've taken it once, it's probably done something to you. It's too volatile. One epic of that period was an acid-fueled road trip with John Lennon. An episode of such extremes that I can barely piece together a fragment. It took in, I thought, Torquay and Lyme Regis over what seemed like a 2 or 3 day period with the chauffeur. Johnny and I were so out there that sometimes, years later in New York, he would ask, what happened on that trip? With us was Carrie Ann Moeller, now Mrs. Chris Jagger. I think the Hollies wrote a song about her. It was about Marianne. Very sweet girl. Had a place on Portland Square, where I lived when in town for about 2 years. Her reminiscences, which I sought out recently for this book, were quite different from mine. But hers were at least not almost a total blank like mine. What is clear to me now is that we never thought we were overworked, but later on, you realize you didn't give yourself a break, boy. So when we had 3 unfamiliar days off, we got a little wild. I remembered going in a chauffeur-driven car, but Carrie Ann says we didn't have a chauffeur. We went in a cramped 2-door car with 1 other identifiable passenger. So maybe we did have a chauffeur. According to Carrie Ann, we started in Dolly's nightclub, the precursor of Tramp, and drove round Hyde Park Corner several times, wondering where to go. We drove to John's house in the country, she says, and said hi to Cynthia. And then Carrie Ann decided we'd go and visit her mum in Lyme Regis. What a nice visit for a mother. A couple of flying acid heads who'd been up for a couple of nights. We got there about dawn, so her story goes. 1 greasy spoon calf wouldn't serve us. John got recognized. and Carrie Anne realized that we couldn't go and visit her mother because we were so out of it. There follow, therefore, some missing hours, because we didn't get back to John's house until after dark. There were palm trees, so it looks as if we sat on the Torquay, palm-lined esplanade for a great many hours, engrossed in a little world of our own. We got home, and so everyone was happy. It was one of those cases of John wanting to do more drugs than me. Huge bag of weed, lump of hash, and acid. I usually pick my spots with acid. Moving around didn't come into it if you could avoid it. I liked John a lot. He was a silly sod in many ways. I used to criticize him for wearing his guitar too high. They used to wear them up by their chests, which really constricts your movement. It's like being handcuffed. Got your fucking guitar on your fucking chin, for Christ's sake. It ain't a violin. I think they thought it was a cool thing. Jerry and the Pacemakers, all the Liverpool bands did it. We used to fuck around like that. Try a longer strap, John. The longer the strap, the better you play. I remember him nodding and taking it in. Next time I saw them, the guitar straps were a little lower. I'd say, no wonder you don't swing, you know? No wonder you can only rock. No wonder you can't roll. John could be quite direct. The only rude thing I remember him saying to me was about my solo in the middle of It's All Over Now. He thought it was crap. Maybe he got out the wrong side of the bed that day. Okay, it certainly could have been better. But you disarmed the man. Yeah, it wasn't one of my best, John. Sorry, sorry it jars, old boy. You can play it any fucking way you like. But that he even bothered to listen meant that he was very interested. He was so open. In anybody else, it could be embarrassing. But John had this honesty in his eyes that made you go for him. Had an intensity, too. He was a one-off. Like me. We were attracted to each other in a strange way. Definitely a two-alpha clash to start with. Post-acid was the prevailing mood at Redlands on a cold February morning in 1967. Post-acid. Everybody arrives back with their feet on the ground, so to speak, and you've been with them all day, doing all kind of nut things and laughing your head off. You've gone for walks on the beach, and you're freezing cold, and you're not wearing any shoes, and you're wondering why you've got frostbite. The come down hits everybody in a different way. Some people are going, let's do it again, and others are going, enough already. And you can flash back into full acid drive at any moment. There's a knock at the door. I look through the window, and there's this whole lot of dwarfs outside. But they're all wearing the same clothes. They were policemen, but I didn't know it. They just looked like very small people, wearing dark blue with shiny bits and helmets. Wonderful attire. Am I expecting you? Anyway, come on in. It's a bit chilly out. They were trying to read a warrant to me. Oh, that's very nice, but it's a bit cold outside. Come on in and read it to me over the fireplace. I'd never been busted before, and I was still on acid. Ah, make friends, love. Not from me, would there be. You cannot come in until I speak to my lawyer. It was, yeah, come on in. And then roughly disabused. While we're gently bouncing down from the acid, they're trampling through the place, doing what they've got to do. And none of us are really taking much notice of them. Obviously, there was a shiver of the usuals, but there didn't seem to be much we could do about it at that moment, so we just let them walk about and look in ashtrays. Incredibly enough, what they did come up with was only a few roaches and what Mick and Robert Fraser had in their pockets, which was a minute amount of amphetamine, bought legally by Mick in Italy, and in Robert's case, heroin tabs. Otherwise, we just carried on. There was the thing, of course, of Marianne. Hard day on acid. She'd taken a bath upstairs, just finished. and I had this huge fur rug made of pelts of some kind, rabbit, and she just wrapped herself up in it. I think she had a towel around her too and was lying back on a couch after a nice bath. How the Mars bar got into the story, I don't know. Well, there was one on the table. Well, there were a couple. Because on acid, suddenly, you get sugar-lack and you're munching away. And so she's stuck forever with the story of where the police found that Mars bar. And you have to say, she wears it well. But how that connotation came about and how the press managed to make a Mars bar on a table and Marianne wrapped in a fur rug into a myth is a kind of classic. In fact, Marianne was quite chastely attired for once. Usually, when first you said hi to Marianne, you started talking to the cleavage. And she knew she was thrusting it. A naughty lady, bless her heart. She was more dressed in this fur bedspread than she'd been all day. So they had a woman police officer who took her upstairs and made her drop the rug. What else do you want to see? From there, shows you what's in people's minds, the evening paper headlines are Naked Girl at Stone's Party. Info directly from the police. But the Mars bar is a dildo? Well, that's rather a large leap. The weird thing about these myths is that they stick when they're so obviously false. Perhaps the idea is that it's so outlandish or crude or prurient that it can't have been invented. Imagine allowing a group of policemen and women to see this evidence, keeping it on display as they came tramping through the house. Excuse me, officer, I think you may have missed something. Over here. Others at Redlands that day were Christopher Gibbs and Nicky Kramer. An upper-class drifter and hanger-on who befriended everybody. A harmless enough soul who was innocent of betraying us. Although David Litvinoff held him out of a window by his ankles to find out. And of course, Mr. X, as he was later referred to in court. David Schneiderman. Schneiderman, who also went by the moniker of Acid King, was the source of that very high-quality acid of the time. Such brands as Strawberry Fields, Sunshine, and Purple Haze. Where do you think Jimmy got that from? All kinds of mixtures. And that's how Schneiderman got in on the crowd. By providing this super-duper acid. In those innocent days, now abruptly ended. Nobody bothered about the cool guy, the dealer in the corner. One big happy party. In fact, the cool guy was the agent of the constabulary. He came with this bag full of goodies, including a lot of DMT, which we'd never had before. Dimethyltryptamine. One of the ingredients of ayahuasca, a very powerful psychedelic. He was at every party for about 2 weeks, and then mysteriously disappeared and was never seen again. The bust was a collusion between the News of the World and the cops, but the shocking extent of the stitch-up, which reached to the judiciary, didn't become apparent until the case came to court months later. Mick had threatened to sue the scandal rag, for mixing him up with Brian Jones and describing him taking drugs in a nightclub. In return, they wanted evidence against Mick to defend themselves in court. It was Patrick, my Belgian chauffeur, who sold us out to the News of the World, who in turn tipped off the cops, who used Schneiderman. I'm paying this driver handsomely, and the gig's the gig. Keep stum. But the News of the World got to him. Didn't do him any good. As I heard it, he never walked the same again. But it took us time to piece these little details together. As far as I remember, the atmosphere was fairly relaxed at the time. Shit, anything we'd done already. It was only later on, the next day, when we started to get the letters from solicitors and everything, Her Majesty's Government and blah, 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 we thought, ah, this is serious. We decided to get out of England and not go back until it was time for the court case. And it would be better to find somewhere where we could get legal drugs. It was one of those sudden things. Let's jump in the Bentley and go to Morocco. So in early March, we did a runner. We've got free time and we've got the best car to do it in. This was Blue Lena, as it was christened. My dark blue Bentley, my S3 Continental Flying Spur. An automobile of some rarity, one of a limited edition of 87. It was named in honor of Lena Horne. I sent her a picture of it. Having this car was already heading for trouble. Breaking the rules of the establishment, driving a car I was definitely not born into. Blue Lena carried us on many an acid fuel journey. Modifications included a secret compartment in the frame for the concealing of illegal substances. It had a huge bonnet, and to turn it, you really had to swing it about. Blue Lena required some art and knowledge of its contours and tight situations. It was 6 inches wider at the back than the front. You got to know your car, no doubt about that. 3 tons of machinery. A car that was made to be driven fast at night. Brian and Anita had been to Morocco the previous year, 1966, staying with Christopher Gibbs, who had to take Brian to hospital with a broken wrist after a punch he'd thrown at Anita had hit the metal window frame in the El Minzah Hotel in Tangier. He was never good at connecting with Anita. I learned later just how violent Brian had already become with her as the downward slide began, throwing knives, glass, punches at her, forcing her to barricade herself behind sofas. It's probably not well known that Anita had a very sporty childhood. Sailing, swimming, skiing, outdoor sports of every kind. Brian was no match for Anita, physically or in terms of wit. She was always on top of it. He always came off second best. And she thought, at the start at least, that Brian's rampages were quite funny. But they were becoming unfunny and dangerous. Anita told me later that at Torremolinos, on the way to Tangier the previous year, they had had massive fights after which Brian ended up in jail. And Anita, too, once for stealing a car coming out of a club. She was often trying to bail Brian out, screaming at the turnkeys, "You can't keep him in jail! Let him out!" All this time, they had grown to look like each other. Their hair and clothes were becoming identical. They'd merged their personas, stylistically at least. We flew to Paris, Brian, Anita and I, and met Deborah Dixon, an old friend of Anita, in the Hotel George V. Deborah was a piece of work. A beauty from Texas who had been on every magazine cover in the early 60s. Brian and Anita first met on the Stones tour, but it was in Deborah's house in Paris that they first got together. My new driver to replace the snitch Patrick, Tom Keelock, tough bloke from North London, soon to become the Stones' fixer-in-chief, brought Blue Lena over to Paris and we set off for the sun. I sent a postcard to Mum. "Dear Mum, sorry I didn't phone before I left, but my telephones aren't safe to talk on. Everything will be all right, so don't worry. It's really great here, and I'll send you a letter when I get where I'm going. All my love, your fugitive son, Keith." Brian, Deborah, and Anita occupied the back seat, and I sat in the front next to Tom Keelock, changing the 45s on the little Philips car record player. It's hard to know on this journey how and why the tension built up in the car as it did. It was helped on by Brian being even more obnoxious and childish than usual. Tom's an old soldier. Ford at Arnhem and everything like that. But even he couldn't ignore the tension in that car. Brian's relationship With Anita, I had reached a jealous stalemate when she refused to give up whatever acting work she was doing to fulfill domestic duties as his full-time geisha, flatterer, punchbag, whatever he imagined, including partaker in orgies, which Anita always resolutely refused to do. On this trip, he never stopped complaining and whining about how ill he felt, how he couldn't breathe. No one took him seriously. Brian certainly suffered from asthma, but he was also a hypochondriac. Meanwhile, I was the DJ. I had to keep feeding the goddamn thing with little 45s. The favourite sounds, much Motown at the time. Anita claims that these choices were full of meaning and communication to her. Songs of the moment like Chantilly Lace and Hey Joe. All songs are like that. You can take the meaning any way you want. The first night of our journey through France, we stayed all in the same room. Five of us in a kind of dormitory in the top of a house. The only accommodation we could find late at night. Next day, we got to a town called Cordes-sur-Ciel that Deborah wanted to see. A pretty village on top of a hill. And from out of its medieval walls, as we approached, emerged an ambulance. And at this point, Brian insisted that we should follow it to the nearest hospital, which was in Albi. There, Brian was diagnosed with pneumonia. Well, it was hard to know with Brian what was real and what wasn't. But this meant that he was transferred to a Toulouse hospital, where he would stay for several days, and it was there we left him. I discovered much later that he gave instructions to Deborah not to leave Anita and me alone together. So it was pretty clear to him. We said, okay, Brian, you're cool. We'll drive down through Spain, then you fly over to Tangier. So Anita and Deborah and I drove into Spain, and when we reached Barcelona, we went out to a famous flamenco guitar joint in the Ramblas. Then it was a rough part of town, and when we came outside about 3 in the morning, there's a semi-riot going on. People were throwing things at the Bentley violently, especially when they saw us. Maybe they were anti-rich, anti-us. Maybe it was because I was flying the Pope's flag that day. I used to have a little flagpole on the car and I would change the flags around. The cops came and suddenly I'm in kangaroo court in the middle of the night in Barcelona. A low room with tiles and a judge presiding over these nocturnal assizes. Opposite him, a long bench with about 100 guys all lined up, with me at the end of the row. And suddenly, these cops came in, and they started to beat everyone down the line with truncheons round their head. Everyone got one. And they knew what was coming. It looked to me like a pretty normal process. You get into that court at night, and you get the usual. And I'm the last cat on the end of the bench. Tom went to get my passport and took hours. And when he finally procured it, I flashed it in their face. Her Majesty demands. And they did the guy right next to me. After about 99 broken heads, well, I guess they were going to do the whole bench. But they didn't. The judge wanted me to confirm the culprits they had chosen, having rounded up the usual suspects. To charge with smashing the car and causing the riot. But I wouldn't do that. So it came down to a fine for parking in the wrong place. A piece of paper to sign, money to change hands, and even then they kept us in jail for the rest of the night. Next day, we got the windscreen fixed and set off with fresh hope, but not with Deborah, who had had enough of tension and police cells and wanted to go back to Paris. With no one to watch over us, we drove on to Valencia. And between Barcelona and Valencia, Anita and I found out that we were really interested in each other. I have never put the make on a girl in my life. I just don't know how to do it. my instincts are always to leave it to the woman, which is kind of weird, but I can't pull the come on bit. Hey, baby, how you doing? Come on, let's get it on and all of that. I'm tongue-tied. I suppose every woman I've been with, they've had to put the make on me. Meanwhile, I'm putting the make on in another way, by creating an aura of insufferable tension. Somebody has to do something. You either get the message or you don't, but I could never make the first move. I knew how to operate amongst women, because most of my cousins were women, so I felt very comfortable in their company. If they're interested, they'll make the move. That's what I found out. So, Anita made the first move. I could just not put the make on my friend's girl, even though he'd become an arsehole to Anita too. It's the Sir Galahad in me. Anita was beautiful too. And we got closer and closer. And then suddenly, without her old man, she had the balls to break the ice and say, fuck it. In the back of the Bentley, somewhere between Barcelona and Valencia, Anita and I looked at each other. The tension was so high in the back seat. The next thing I know, she's giving me a blowjob. The tension broke then. And suddenly, we're together. You don't talk a lot when that shit hits you. Without even saying things, you have the feeling, the great sense of relief that something has been resolved. It was February, and in Spain it was early spring. Going through England and France, it was pretty chill, it was winter. We got over the Pyrenees, and within half an hour already, it was spring. And by the time we got to Valencia, it was summer. I still remember the smell of the orange trees in Valencia. When you get laid with Anita Pallenberg for the first time, you remember things. We stopped in Valencia overnight and checked in as Count and Countess Ziggenpuss. And that was the first time I made love to Anita. And from Algeciras, where we checked in as Count and Countess Castiglione, we took the ferry in the car over to Tangier, to the El Minza Hotel. There in Tangier were Robert Fraser, Bill Burroughs, Brian Gyson, Burroughs' friend and fellow cut-up artist, another of the hip public schoolboys, and Bill Willis, decorator of Exiles' Palaces. We were greeted by a bundle of telegrams from Brian, ordering Anita to come back and collect him. But we weren't going anywhere except the Casbah and Tangier. For a week or so, it's boinky, boinky, boinky down in the Casbah, and we're randy as rabbits, but we're also wondering how we're going to deal with it. Because we were expecting Brian in Tangier. We only dropped them off to have treatment. We were both, I remember, trying to be polite, at least for each other's benefit. When Brian gets to Tangier, we'll do this and that. Let's make a phone call to see if he's all right, and all of that. And at the same time, that was the last thing on our minds. The truth was, oh God, Brian's going to turn up in Tangier, and then we've got to start playing a fucking game. Yeah, I hope he croaks. Suddenly, it's Anita. Is she with him or with me? We realized we were creating an unmanageable situation, maybe threatening the survival of the band. We decided to pull back to make a strategic retreat. Anita didn't want to abandon Brian. Didn't want to go, tears and crying. She was worried about the effect on the group, that this was the big betrayal and it might bring it all down. I just can't be seen with you. It's too dangerous, baby. I just can't be, yes, I gotta chill this thing with you. A song called Can't Be Seen. We visited Ahmed, a legendary hashish dealer of those early drug days. Anita had met him first with Chrissy Gibbs on a previous visit. A small Moroccan man with a Chinese jar on his shoulder walking along, looking back at them, leading them through the Medina, up the hill towards the Minza, opening the door into a tiny little shop that was completely empty, except for a box with a few pieces of Moroccan jewellery in it and a lot of hashish. His shop was on the stairs, called the Escalier Walla, going down from the Minza. Little one-story shops on the right-hand side that backed onto the Minza Gardens. Ahmed started off with one shop, and then he had two above it. There were steps between them. Internally, it was a bit of a labyrinth, and the higher ones just had a few brass beds with gaudy-coloured velvet mattresses on them, on which one could, having smoked a lot of dope, pass out for a day or two. And then you come in, and he give you some more dope to make you more passed out. It was almost like a basement, and it was hung with all the wonders of the East. Caftan, rugs, and beautiful lanterns. Aladdin's cave. It was a shack, but he made it look like a palace. Ahmed Holinhead, we used to call him. Because he said his prayers so often, he had a hole in the middle of his forehead. He was a good salesman. First thing, he gets the mint tea, and then a pipe. He was somewhat on the spiritual side, and as he gave you your pipe, he would usually tell you some thrilling adventure of the prophet in the wilderness. He was a good ambassador for his faith and a cheerful soul. Also, a typical Moroccan little shyster. He had gaps in his teeth, and he had this great smile that never left. Once he started smiling, it was there all the time, and he kept looking at you. But he had such good shit, you kind of went to the land of milk and honey there. And after a few rounds of this, it was almost as if you were on acid. In and out he went, bringing sweet meats and candies, and it was very difficult to get out. You think you're going to have a quick one and then do something else, but very rarely would you do anything else. You could stay there all day, all night. You could live there. And always, Radio Cairo was static, slightly off the tuning. The Moroccan specialty was keef. The leaf cut up with tobacco, which they smoked in long pipes. Sebsi, they called them, the tiny little bowl on the end. One hit in the morning with a cup of mint tea. But what Ahmed had in large quantities, in which he imbued with a new glamour, was a kind of hash. It was called hash because it came in chunks, but it wasn't hash, strictly speaking. Hash is made from the resin, and this was loose powder, like pollen, from the dried bud of the plant, compressed into shape, which is why it was that green colour. I heard that a way of collecting it was to cover children in honey and run them naked through a field of herb, and they come out the other end and they scraped them off. Ahmed had three or four different qualities, decided by which kind of stocking he put it through. There would be the coarser ones, and there would be the 24 denier. Very close to the dirham, the money. The high-quality one went through the finest, finest silk. It was just powder by then. That was my first touch of Africa. Within the short bus from Spain over to Tangier, you were in another world. It could have been 1,000 years ago, and you either went, "How weird," or you went, "Wow, this is great." And we love to be transported. We were already heavy-duty smokers. One could say we were going round as hash inspectors. We used to do so much of it. "We must reconsider our ideas on drugs," wrote Cecil Beaton in his diary. "It seems these boys live off them, yet they seem extremely healthy and strong." We will see. Anita's dilemma, apart from the guilt of his betrayal and her passionate and destructive attachment to Brian, was that Brian was still very wobbly and sick, and she felt she should look after him. So Anita went back to get Brian, took him from Toulouse to London for more medical attention, and then, with Marianne, who was coming to join Mick in Marrakesh for the weekend, brought him at first to Tangier. Brian had been doing a lot of acid, and he was in a weak physical state from his pneumonia. So to stiffen him up, Anita and Marianne, the nursing sisters, gave him a tab of acid on the plane. Anita and Marianne had both been up all the previous night on acid, and according to Anita, when they finally